Accession number 19909, Reel 3.
I'll let you ask a question.
Warwick Taylor, Reel 3. Were there trade unions down there that you had to join?
There were trade unions, yes, but none of us actually joined the trade union. I don't think we were interested to. They did ask us about this, you know, you'll be expected to join a union and all this, and most of us thought, oh, we'll blow that, we're not here long enough, you know, this is it. And we didn't. I don't really know of any Bevin boy that actually joined a trade union, but I imagine it's possible they might have in other areas. But certainly I didn't.
Were there any industrial disputes whilst you were at Oakdale?
No, I can record no industrial disputes whatsoever. You've got to realise this is wartime, of course. There was no time for any nonsense like industrial disputes. And, of course, it was work and pay.
Though part of the time it was after the war, wasn't it?
Yes, it was after the war. Everybody during wartime was absolutely keyed up and they put maximum effort into everything right across the country. And I think this is where we went wrong, because when war finished, we just let go. Everybody thought, well, that's it. We can now sit back and put our feet up. The job is done. It's all finished. And I think that's a mistake that we made.
What did the attitude of the men seem to be towards employers?
To be honest, we didn't see very much of our employers, and I don't ever recall seeing the colliery manager. It's possible that I don't think the colliery manager ever goes underground anyway. He probably sends one of his deputies to do this. I never saw a colliery manager at all. A colliery, of course, is a very big complex. It's spread out over several acres, and the manager's probably sitting in his office somewhere tucked out of the way. It's possible, I probably don't remember, but it's possible the colliery manager did come to have a word with us when we first arrived there and we were in the classroom. It's quite possible that he sort of said, well, welcome, you know, I'm so-and-so. I don't really remember that. Most of the classroom work, of course, is on safety aspects, because there are a lot of dangers down a coal mine. There's no question about it. And when I think about it, in those days, it's nothing to do. The safety standards of today are totally different. I mean, the mere fact in those days that we wore steel-capped boots could have been a high risk, you know. You only want a spark coming off there on one of the stones, the floor, and that's it. You could set off an explosion. But that was the greatest risk underground, was fire damp, which is methane gas, virtually, and it's... I seem to remember there was we were evacuated. There was the deputy had... They have a safety lamp down there. Down at Oakdale, the lamps that we had were attached to our helmets. We also had a battery-type lamp. These battery lamps were called either lighthouse lamps or bombies, as they were called down there. And they're battery-operated, but they cannot detect gas. That's why there always has to be a flame safety lamp down there. And I think they detected one day a rather slightly high measure of methane gas in the particular area, and they evacuated us out of it.
Where was the flame safety lamp kept?
It was always kept in the deputy's office down there, and certain miners also carried them as well. The shot firer, for instance, always carried one of these lamps. So here and there you would see somebody carrying one of these flame safety lamps. I didn't carry one myself. I always had this the battery lamp, which basically was to see your way. Some of the underground collars, of course, were well illuminated, well lit. Other areas weren't. You were in total darkness.
Was there any talk amongst the regular miners or others about impending nationalisation?
That's a good question, asking me that from Wales. They all spoke in Welsh amongst themselves. Yes, I think there was some there was talk about this nationalisation. I think they were all for it, really, because they thought, well, this is good. We're going to get better pay and conditions now. You've got to realise that there were 1,886 collieries in the United Kingdom in 1945. Now, all these collieries were going to be put under the umbrella of the National Coal Board. They call that Vesting Day, and it took place on the 1st of January 1947. Now, this is when, of course, all the collieries came under the one umbrella of the National Coal Board.
But you weren't there then.
I wasn't there then, no. But most Bevan boys were at that particular time, of course, because, as I say, it wasn't until 1948 that they were released, which happened to coincide with my RAF service, because I was demobilised in 1948, and they counted my coal mining service as a Bevan boy as continuous service in the Air Force. So my demobilisation number was geared up to the total amount of service.
Where did you live whilst you were working at Oakdale?
I lived my whole entire time in the hostel. Incidentally, that after my double pneumonia, it was a question of having to go back. Oh, my father had to bring me up some clothes from home, of course. But I had to go back to the hostel to pick up the rest of my clothing, but the whole lot had gone. It had been stolen. The locker had been, because I'd been away then for what? I hadn't been in the billet for nearly 2 months. The locker had been broken into. We all had a padlocking key. And everything had gone, and nobody seemed to know where it was. So that was my clothing and my equipment. My lamp snapped in, the lot had gone.
Who do you think had taken it?
No idea at all where that had gone. It could have been taken by another Bevan boy. I wouldn't have thought so. It could have been removed, of course, and put somewhere that nobody knew anything about it. The hostels are run by a resident manager, and he's the man that is responsible for the whole satisfactory running of these hostels. Incidentally, they hold up to 500 residents, so there were nearly 500 of us in this particular hostel. I should say that not all the Bevan boys that were in the hostel at Oakdale worked at Oakdale. This hostel covered several collieries within the area, and they would be bused to a colliery where they'd be working. But at the end of the shift, back they'd come to Oakdale for their accommodation and feeding.
What were your living conditions like?
I think they were pretty good. Yeah, they were pretty satisfactory. Yes. Yeah. I mean, you had sheets, which is something I didn't have when I went into the Air Force. Just blankets. So yes, they were pretty good. These hostels were really purpose built and self supporting. Food, well, of course, when you're 18 years of age, of course, you're always hungry. You'll eat anything. And so the food, as I say, was a very bland diet, but very sustaining. Because during wartime, there were two main ingredients to every cooked meal. And it was mashed potatoes and Swedes. And you had this right throughout, basically throughout wartime. The whole nation virtually lived on those two things. Other things, of course, were in short supply. We did as Bevan boys get extra cheese allowance. One was normally rationed as a civilian. You'd only get something like 2 ounces of cheese a week, but I think we got four, double the quantity if you were a Bevan boy. Reason being, of course, it was a labour-intensive job and you needed the strength. And then you need the calorie support, didn't you, to carry out that sort of job.
Any memories of the 45 general election?
Not really, no. I suppose at that age one wasn't basically involved in politics at all. Of course, at 45 I was still in the mines at that particular time.
Anything you'd like to say about your service in the RAF, please?
Service in RAF? I had the time of my life. I thought that this this is great. I reported to RAF Padgate for 10 days. I was kitted out. I was then sent to RAF Yatesbury in Wiltshire for my basic training, which took 2 months. I was then picked out. I wanted to do my trade as a radio operator. But they said, oh no, you're not going to do that yet. We're sending you to RAF Horton for a ceremonial drill course. Well, this was sort of really a different sort of drill training. You know, it was, you were doing drill by numbers, silently. And I quite enjoyed that. It was basically what we called square bashing and nothing else. After that, they said, right, we're now posting you to RAF Cranwell, to number one radio school, for your radio course. Well, the only radio, I couldn't be a radio operator because, well, they weren't recruiting air crew anymore and they didn't require them. They said the trade is, with anything you can train for, is a radio telephony operator. So then that's fine. I did the course, passed out, and they said, the trade is now redundant, you've got to remuster. So they said, there's a choice. A cook, RAF police, or motor transport. So I said, motor transport. So they sent me to RAF Wharton in Lancashire, which was Lytham St Anne's, not very far from Blackpool, where I spent the last 18 months of my RAF life learning to drive. And I think they were the best years of my life, actually, there. It was Blackpool every night. I learned to drive, which I couldn't drive before. I learned to drive, by the way, not in a car as they do today, but in a 10-ton Thornycroft. And that's how I learned my driving, in Thornycroft and Bedfords. And I got demobilised finally in 1948 and back into civilian life. Of course, I didn't have a job to return to because, as I mentioned much earlier, that in any event, although it was mandatory to hold open your civilian job if you were in the forces, it wasn't held open if you were a Bevin boy because it was classified as a civilian occupation. But I hadn't got the job to go back to anyway, so I sort of enjoyed my demobilisation leave because I had demob suit, gratuity, everything. All the things that you didn't get as a Bevin boy, I now got. And I got demobbed and looked around for a job and I decided to take a job working for British Overseas Airways Corporation at London's Heathrow Airport, where I remained for the rest of my working life. British Overseas Airways Corporation, BOAC as it was called, eventually became British Airways. I served 32 years and ended up as a duty manager. We were duty officers, then became duty superintendent and duty managers. I then took an early retirement, took a handshake, I couldn't refuse, but I still hadn't got sufficient stamps on my card to qualify for the full old age pension when it was due. You needed 44 years of working service to qualify. So I had to do a little bit, I had to find another job. So I thought, well, having worked at Heathrow Airport, I might as well, I like the environment there after 32 years, I might as well serve another 8 years at Heathrow Airport. And everybody knew me at Heathrow after being there from the year dot. I was known by everybody and I got the name Poacher turned gamekeeper because I joined Customs and Excise. And I did 8 years with them. So I spent a total of 40 years at London's Heathrow Airport, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
How do you feel now about having served as a Bevin boy?
Well, these days, of course, are long, long, it's all history now, but I'm very much involved today with the Bevin Boys Association. We started this 10 years ago with 32 members. We've now got over 1,500 members today. And today, it's a full-time job for me as their vice president, but I'm not just that, it's not just a figurehead. I'm also their archivist. I'm their public relations press and publicity officer as well. And this has now become a full-time job. It's a lot of people to look after. It's not like a sort of local organisation where you've got about 30 living in the town. I'm looking after 1,500 plus worldwide. not only the United Kingdom, we've got many members who live overseas in Canada, America, Australia.
What's the attitude of most of them to having served as Bedouin boys?
I think the attitude really today of most of them is the fact. I think if you ask them, a lot will feel the same, that they didn't want to go. They were very resentful about the fact they had to go. And I think they're rather resentful of the fact that the public at large think that we were sent down the mines because we were conscientious objectors. We objected to serving in a fighting force. This is not the case at all. There were 47,859 Bedouin boys. 50,000 was the target in 18 months, but of course the war ended, so we just fell short of that. And out of that number, only 41 were conscientious objectors. It's a negligible quantity. And a lot of the public seem to think they're under this misnomer that that's why we were there. But of course, you must understand, not all Bedouin boys were balloted. Some actually had the option of serving in the mine. This is a case where they went to register for national service, but they hadn't been balloted. Their number hadn't been drawn. And they were given this option. They could go there instead of going in. But it was more on a voluntary basis. It was up to them. They could decide.
So some people volunteered rather than going to the service.
And it's roughly a half and half basis of that total number that I've given you. That about 23,000 were balloted and the balance were optants or volunteers.
Was it just men who had to do it?
Yes. Yes, only men, yes. But today the association is... it's going from strength to strength, but my basic concern was really to get recognition for the Bedouin boys, because we didn't get a medal. We got absolutely nothing. We didn't get gratuity, the mob suits, absolutely nothing. A completely secret underground movement, if you like. Not in the underground movement that is normally meant, but we did serve underground. And this recognition's only sort of just come out in recent years. We got the first recognition we got was on the VE and VJ Day commemorations in 1995, in May and August. In May, we got the first mention by Her Majesty the Queen, Betty Boothroyd, Speaker of the House of Commons, and the then Prime Minister, John Major, who mentioned us specifically in speeches. For the VJ Day commemorations in London in August that year, we were allowed to march in the parade down the Mall and were again mentioned. So this was basically, at last we were beginning to get some form of recognition. You know, a lot of people think, Bedouin boys, who are they? And then we've now got permission to parade at the Cenotaph in London. And last year was the first year that we were allowed to actually have a contingent of Bedouin boys marching down across Horsecrafts Parade into Whitehall and past the Cenotaph. And again, this year was the second year that we were allowed to do this. And I was very happy to lead our contingent this year at the Cenotaph. We were all wearing miners' helmets, of course. You can't get the black. I wore an original Bedouin boy helmet, and the rest of them had modern day, the white miners' helmets. And there were 70 of us. It was a very, very proud moment for us that at last we were getting that recognition.
Have you had any long term effects from having served down the pit?
I think I get a lot of catarrh on the chest. It was probably due to that double pneumonia and the scar on the lung that resulted in that. But it's no problem. Some of the Bedouin boys today do, or have been trying to make claims, because later on in life these things have a habit of coming out. And one or two said to me, "Can I help them with their cases?" You know, but it's impossible to make a claim. It's too late. It's long gone. They can't make claims now, unfortunately. But certain things are coming out later in life, like deafness or chest infections, this kind of thing. It's really a delayed reaction to it, I think. The Bedouin Boy Association today, we're a very, very strong movement, and we have regular national and regional reunions. We have two national reunions. One includes an AGM. And we tend to hold these in different parts of the country, usually associated with coal mining. We've just recently held one in York, for instance, and we arranged a visit to the National Coal Mining Museum for England at Capphouse Colliery near Wakefield, Yorkshire, where actually, in actual fact, we all went underground again, because you can actually go underground as a visitor. So this brought back many memories in, what, 55 years for ex-Bevin boys. That's the first time they've been underground again. And after that, the next day we went to Eden Camp in Malton, Yorkshire, where there's also a small display about the Bevin boy there. There's also in the chapel there at Eden Camp, we have a brass plaque dedicated to all the Bevin boys that served during the Second World War. Regional reunions, these are held in all parts of the country throughout the year. Bristol, Norfolk, northern parts of the country, all over the place. And it's my job as the public relations to coordinate all these and keep these going. Next year we're going to hold a very big reunion. We're calling it the Millennium Special. We're going to hold this in Edinburgh, because we feel we would like to see a lot more Scottish members joining the association, and we feel they don't join because they feel rather we're far too south of the border and they're way out of it there. So we want to try and take the Bevin Boy Association to them up in Edinburgh. And we've arranged a reunion next April there at the University of Edinburgh. This should be a great millennium event. There's another very big event taking place in Coventry, at Coventry Cathedral, next March, March 2000. And this is a service of dedication to all those who served during the Second War in a civilian capacity, such as the Bevin boys, the Land Army girls, the munition workers, people involved in transport, all civilians who didn't really receive any recognition. And there's to be a plaque unveiled there in the grounds of the old Coventry Cathedral. It'll be unveiled by a senior member of royalty. And this, again, will be another step towards recognition for the services that we contributed to the war effort, which indeed was vital and very, very essential.